Today is Wednesday. It's March 2nd, 2023, and it's 2:37 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. And this is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Remember, you can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon of WTTW News.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the mouth in the South, publisher of the Picayune Sentinel and occasional columnist for the Daily Herald.
Are you still down in, Savannah?
Still down in Savannah. Yeah, we're leaving on Sunday, coming back.
Last we spoke with you, Eric, you were going to have dinner with the guy who was the attorney in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. How did that go?
Yeah, it went really well. He was the prosecutor in the case, and he is good friends with Mary Schmeek, who is down here also. She is staying with Spencer and his wife. And we had dinner last night, and it was delightful. He's an old Southern gentleman and very opinionated, and it was a wonderful time. So,
I don't suppose there's any good dish for you to give us there, huh? Any good?
He was the elected state's attorney down here in Calhoun County for a long time, and he says people who run for public office are kind of crazy, in his opinion. so that actually would lead us into a conversation about Arne Duncan and why he's not running for mayor, but we'll get to that a little bit later, I guess. So.
I can't believe I'm announcing this, but former House Speaker Mike Madigan was indicted today on federal racketeering charges. That's incredible.
Let me just read the story. This is not Greg Pratt. This is Jason Meisner and Ray Long. Even as we speak, it's moved online. Former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan, for decades the most powerful politician in the state, was indicted Wednesday, that's today, on federal racketeering charges, alleging an array of bribery schemes aimed at using the power of his office for personal gain. The indictment was returned by a federal grand jury after more than a two-year investigation. According to federal prosecutors, among the alleged schemes outlined in the indictment was a plan by utility giant Commonwealth Edison to pay thousands of dollars to lobbyists favored by Madigan in order to win his influence over legislation the company wanted passed in Springfield. The indictment also accused Madigan of illegally soliciting businesses for his private property tax law firm during discussions to turn a state-owned parcel of land in Chinatown into a commercial development. Finally, they write, though the land deal never was consummated, it's been a source of continued interest for federal investigators. Several key players have been involved. Madigan, 79, Southwest Side Democrat, was dethroned from his role as Speaker in January of 21 and later resigned his House seat, has previously denied wrongdoing. He was not arrested today, Wednesday. He's expected to appear for arraignment at a later date. John Lausch, we knew going into this podcast, was going to be at that press conference, so we figured it would be a pretty big fish, and looks like it is the biggest, the one-time biggest fish of them all.
Well, my reaction is some surprise, given that the longer this had gone on, the longer he had been under the microscope and the longer he hadn't been indicted, that it looked to me like maybe they just couldn't get the goods on it, that he was a very careful person. He famously didn't do any email, and seemed like everything was done in sort of coded language and nods and winks. And so I was thinking that maybe they said, well, you know what, there's lots of smoke here, but we don't see the fire. And like I said, the longer it went on, the longer I thought, well, maybe he's not going to be indicted, that it's just going to be everybody around him. But it might be that what has happened is that in the last few months, that some of the people who they have indicted, who are closer to him, have flipped on him finally. And finally had told about what he had said in private conversations. We don't know. I mean, this evidence is not going to be, hasn't been laid out for us yet, but like I say, my initial reaction is some surprise. I mean, I always thought that they're certainly close to him, circling around him. But like I said, I thought that he might've just slipped the news, but I guess not.
At least not in terms of the indictment. He hasn't been, of course, convicted yet.
If the behavior alleged in this indictment is proven in a court of law, it will mean that for most of the past 50 years, so a half century, Illinois has been run by a man who was engaged in a intense and detailed and nearly all-encompassing criminal scheme to enrich himself. It's truly, truly shocking. It essentially alleges that Illinois lawmaking was up for the highest bidder.
Do you think this would have had more teeth if they had been able to get him to indict him while he was in office?
Sure, but I do not want to quote the Wire because that is a cliche. But if you come at the king, you best not miss. And I think that is absolutely the case here, because the last thing John Lausch wanted to do was to get an indictment returned against Mike Madigan and then see him walk on a technicality or even acquitted.
Sure, but it feels like he got away with it too, right? I mean, so maybe he's 79. Maybe he'll go to jail when he's 80. If it's this long-standing scheme that you're describing, and I'm shocked to hear that you're shocked. Well, then I wish they were able to do something about this sooner. You know, the guy's had an enriched and maybe ill-gotten life, Austin, and only now do we finally get him.
Couldn't agree more. And this is the problem. I've spent so many days of my life researching and writing about this guy and how he's unethical and corrupt. And a quote that sticks with me from the end of his reign, where he left office not in handcuffs, not in a coffin, as everyone expected him to leave office, but by the vote of his own colleagues, because they were more afraid of their constituents, finally, than they were of the speaker. And he said, some individuals have spent millions of dollars and worked diligently to establish a false narrative that I am corrupt and unethical. He was corrupt and unethical. And I think this court proceeding will prove that. But to your point, John, Illinoisans have already lost. And it's because of the fact that for so many decades, lawmakers didn't stand up to his power and say, yeah, maybe people shouldn't be allowed to be property tax attorneys and lawmakers at the same time.
Yeah.
Maybe people shouldn't be allowed to be the legislative leader and chairman of the state party at the same time. Maybe the speaker shouldn't have so much power in the House rules that they get more power than any other single lawmaker in any other state legislature throughout the nation. Instead, we're conditioned to believe in Illinois that as long as we scream loud enough, some Fed will come in on a white horse and chop these people's heads off. And the problem is that's not actually how the process works. It takes many, many, many years. And then once you do it, the damage has already been done to an extent. When Madigan became Speaker of the Illinois House in 1983, Illinois had a perfect credit rating. It had the highest credit rating in the country. It was still a beacon of prosperity that shined across the nation. Today, it's the most debt-ridden state with a near-junk credit rating. Its finances are in total shambles, and it's largely because of the political machine that Mike Madigan adapted and scaled from his mentor, Mayor Daley. If folks want to read more about this, I wrote sort of a final piece on him last year in National Review called America's Last Machine Boss Goes Down. And I'll probably write another piece on this. But yeah, it's truly shocking. I remember when I started, I was working on a documentary about the speaker, which you can watch at michaelmadigan.com. And people would come up to me like I was writing a documentary about Putin in Russia. Like, are you checking your car when you're going to, like, it was truly cartoonish, the fear that people had of this man. And if you would have told people then that this is what was happening today, like to Heather's point, they would be shocked. This would blow people's minds that this is happening right now.
Are you surprised, Austin? I know you did that documentary and there was at the time only smoke around Madigan and a lot of innuendo. But there was very little proof, and Bruce Rauner, Governor Rauner, was saying Madigan's corrupt, and we were saying like, well, you know, where was your proof? What do you got here? You're accusing him of being a criminal. Are you surprised that the proof has evidently a sufficient proof has certainly arisen to justify an indictment?
No, because I think the problem was and remains that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And there were so many systems in place in Illinois that gave this one person absolute power that, of course, it was going to be corrupting. Of course, it was used against the interests of the people of Illinois. And that demanded a policy response, that demanded courage, especially from his colleagues in the Illinois Democratic Party, but also from Illinois Republicans, who for a long time were more than happy to play second fiddle to whatever Madigan was doing and pick up his table scraps. The fact that you had someone credibly claiming yeah, people hire my property tax appeals firm because I'm just really good at that business. But also I'm the most powerful. I can singularly decide whether your bill lives or dies. Maybe that's not enough to get an indictment, but it should be enough for our elected officials to stand up and fix that.
Yeah, right.
So I'm not surprised.
Yeah, even if they didn't convict him, that doesn't change the ethic of the thing. They could still do something about it. But you wonder then, do they have something on tape? Did Solis or somebody?
I don't think. I mean, they've had Solis tapes for a long time, so I don't think it would be the Solis tapes. But again, it may just be as they were climbing the ladder toward him that people were looking at long prison terms and saying, you know, maybe I can help you here, and relating conversations. It does seem like Madigan never put anything in writing and was very cagey about how this scheme or whatever was going on worked, that he was not brazen about it. But, you know, you got to look at the record for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago prosecuting political corruption cases. I don't know, is it 90-95% conviction rate? It's very high.
Yeah.
You don't see very many people walking out of that building acquitted. And now you've got Alderman Burke, who was, you know, the dean of the city council, still on the city council, but was this extremely powerful property tax attorney. And you've got Mike Madigan, who was the, you know, the plenipotent leader of the Illinois House and actually of the General Assembly, also in the dock. It's a good day for citizens. It's sort of a dark day in our history that this happened, right? I mean, in retrospect, that he was able to run these alleged schemes for so long.
But he wouldn't go to jail for his history. He'll go to jail for this one time, this one deal that he shouldn't have done. It was the bridge too far, right? Maybe these other things will be evidence, or I don't know if they'll support a conviction. But at the end of the day, it seems like it's this ComEd deal.
True. But at the same time, you got to remember the system that he built. And he is not the first legislative leader to be indicted on corruption charges for taking bribes from utilities. The Ohio House Speaker was indicted for this. You also saw sort of similar stuff in New York with the House Speaker there. The issue was it was one stop shopping for anyone who needed anything done in Springfield. And if you're a utility that's state regulated, of course, you're going to hire the person's friends, whether it was an implicit or explicit ask to get what you want done. And you saw throughout, there's great reporting on the ComEd stuff, Madigan's procedural powers to, in a committee vote, he could on the fly swap out committee members to get the votes that he wanted. I mean, it was a total perversion of democracy. And with that power, you should expect it to be used corruptly. And I hope that is the lesson here in Illinois, is not that, oh, finally, at long last, the, you know, Irish old school political machine is dead in Illinois. It's that we have to build systems that are resilient against this type of political corruption. And that means changing laws.
If you put on your political hack cap and ask, how does this play politically in terms of this coming election in the fall? Is this hurt J.B. Pritzker? He was the leader of the Democratic Party, Madigan was, and he was someone who with just about every top Democrat had relationships with. How successfully has Pritzker distanced himself from Madigan that this sort of scandal isn't going to boil over? Because if you remember the last mayoral election, everybody who was even remotely close to Alderman Burke took a huge hit in the polls. That's why Mayor Lightfoot is our mayor.
I mean, I could see mailers talking about the millions of dollars that Pritzker gave to the Democratic Party when Madigan was chair. Whether that's effective, I don't know. I do think it's notable. I mean, there's plenty that J.B. Pritzker could have been doing on an anti-corruption agenda throughout his administration. He's done very, very, very little. And in fact, is currently in court with a taxpayer-financed lawsuit to remove the patronage hiring watchdog from state government. So I hope that this inspires another round of ethics reform in Springfield that gets serious about things like empowering the legislative inspector general, for example.
Well, can you or Heather walk us through just briefly what the criminal activity was here?
Essentially, it alleges, and we knew most of this before today because it was included in a deferred prosecution agreement with ComEd, and the firm acknowledged that it needed a rate hike, essentially. It needed the approval of the General Assembly to charge Illinois residents more for electric power. And in order to win Mike Madigan's support, and I think, you know, Austin has just laid out a convincing case that if he opposed this, it was going to die. It wasn't going to go anywhere. So they needed his support. And to win his support, they hired people who were close to his 13th ward political operation on the southwest side of the city, and that by hiring them, Madigan ensured that that legislation went forward. So this was a place where people like Mike McLean, who was, you know, basically Madigan's closest aide, landed as a lobbyist. This is where people like Jay Doherty, who had close ties to Madigan while he was president of the City Club, he landed. So this is not sort of what you might think a typical Chicago bribery case looks like. This is not somebody handing Madigan a wad of cash and saying, thanks for voting for this piece of legislation. It was more complicated than that. It's also him using his position as a lawmaker to win business for his property tax appeals firm. And that is, of course, exactly what Alderman Ed Burke has been charged with, and he's awaiting trial after pleading not guilty.
Does it talk about recordings at all? Does it talk about audio evidence or?
So we wouldn't really get that level of detail in an indictment typically. So sometimes when Fed prosecutors release indictments, they release what's called a talking indictment, which is designed to sort of talk to not only the news media and the public, but also the defendant, to sort of put them on notice and say, look, here's what we have. And it's not clear to me at this point whether this indictment is that kind of indictment.
Is there a timeline?
What's the timetable?
Yeah,
I have the same question, John. I mean, I know that Alderman Burke has been under indictment since 2019, I think. So would this be something that we would see 3-4 years from now, this trial?
So that is really up to Mike Madigan and how he wants to play it. So this has been Ed Burke's strategy all along, is to drag this out. He has asked for continuances, and that he has been aided by two things. One, by the shutdown of the federal court system by the COVID-19 pandemic. And two, the fact that his case involves literally hundreds of hours of recorded telephone calls, and that all of that evidence had to be provided to the defense. The defense had to be given time to review that. And now essentially Ed Burke's attorneys have argued that that evidence was improperly seized by the government. That seems very similar to what this Madigan case is going to be. So Ed Burke has been able to drag it out this long because he has nearly unlimited campaign funds he can use to pay his attorney.
Yeah.
Mike Madigan has just as much, if not more, money than Ed Burke. So he will be able to pay for the best defense money can buy, and he will be able to sort of bear the burden of that lengthy trial process, which was not what we saw in the case of Alderman Patrick Daley Thompson, who was convicted 9 months after he was indicted.
I got an idea. This would streamline things, Eric. When people in Illinois or Chicago become a member of the city council or the state legislature, they should automatically indict them. Just kind of get the paperwork rolling. And then, you know, if it turns out to be unnecessary, fine. But mostly we'll be ahead of the game then. What do you think of that, Eric?
Well, what I was going to ask is,
you're not even going to dignify that with a comment.
I'm not
going to
even dignify that with an answer. But I do want to ask how this sheds a light back on Lisa Madigan's term as Attorney General and her kind of puzzling decision just to bow out. She just stepped away from public life, and people had talked about her for a long time as a potential candidate for governor, candidate for mayor,
president.
I didn't hear that, but she was considered to be a real rising star. She just bowed out. And I wonder now in retrospect whether she saw this coming. And she said, you know what, I don't want to be the attorney general. It would be very awkward this afternoon if she were still attorney general and her father was indicted. So the fact that it's Kwame Raoul and not her, and I know it's not, it's a different, you know, this is a state job, and we're talking about a federal indictment. But even still, there was a lot of talk about the fact that Lisa Madigan was attorney general, and the attorney general's office wasn't doing much with corruption. And so I just wonder if the table thinks anything about that.
Well, she was regarded favorably. Didn't we all think she was pretty
good,
AG?
She had a really good reputation. She was a very good vote getter. Not quite as good as Jesse White, but pretty good.
If it wasn't for Lisa Madigan, there would not be a consent decree requiring the Chicago Police Department to reform itself in the wake of Laquan McDonald's police murder.
There was just a lot of talk that it was time for the old man to step aside so that Lisa could run for governor. Now, I don't know if she wanted to. This is all, hidden from our view, but that Mike Madigan did not step down when he was in his early 70s at that point, right? And that would have been a nice time for him to say, you know what, I'm going to go spend time with my grandkids and let my daughter carry on this legacy. But he didn't, and so she stepped away. My sense is that she stepped away, maybe as I'm looking at it in retrospect, and she's like, this is not going to go down well, and I don't want to be in public office when this goes down. I'm just making this up. But.
I'm thinking about Eric, about Austin mentioning power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. The higher up you go, it seems like the more likely it is that you will succumb to that. The leader of the state legislature, the leader of the city council, and how many of our governors in recent memory have gone to jail?
Madigan is really interesting because he never, or really if you look back at his career, only on very few occasions had ambitions for higher office. He became House Speaker, and really as recently as 2012, you look at the polling numbers on Madigan, most people who knew him disliked him at like a 2-to-1 level. But the most common response when asked about Mike Madigan, remember, this is after he's been speaker for more than 20 years, after he's been chairman of the Democratic Party for more than 10 years, after he led the Blagojevich indictment. The most common response for what do you think about Mike Madigan in Illinois was don't know, no opinion. He was able to quietly amass so much power. I should mention, primarily funded by the trial bar and by government worker labor unions, giving him millions and millions and millions of dollars. Those same interests still give millions and millions and millions of dollars to lawmakers today. And that should be a part of the narrative on his corruption and his legacy is those enablers of his. But he was able to amass such power under the radar for so long. And that was really his true political genius.
Well, speaking of politics, mostly Democrats watched the president's State of the Union speech last night. CBS is reporting that 49% of the viewers were self-identified Democrats, 28% identified as independents, and 21% of the audience identified as Republicans. By my count, more Democrats skipped the speech this year than Republicans, but for different reasons. Several Republicans did not attend because they didn't want to take the mandatory COVID test. Even more Democrats didn't go because they did take the test, but they failed. Among them, Lauren Underwood from Illinois tested positive for COVID on Friday, so she could not go. And then people like Marco Rubio were just too busy to get the COVID test. First, should we even have a State of the Union address anymore?
I definitely said this last year for the State of the Union, and maybe the year before. I don't even remember if I was doing this podcast year before, but president should absolutely revert to sending a letter to Congress by courier. I think that the State of the Union is the biggest perennial this meeting could have been an email event in the Western Hemisphere. And I don't know why particularly this time, but this, I probably said this last year too. One thing that really, really kind of weirds me out about the State of the Union is the fact that it has become almost like an awards show of some kind, and that we're all focused on like making memes of people's reactions and like people's fashion choices and stuff. And I feel like short of just eliminating it and sending a letter to Congress, maybe we could all, everybody could just wear black robes and white wigs and have to sit expressionless and motionless there while the president delivers a speech. That would be my compromise position for State of the Union.
Wow.
In general, I would agree with Austin that it's a much ado about nothing usually, and that a lot of the theatrics could be and should be dispensed with. I thought that yesterday was an important time for Biden to be addressing the nation. I don't necessarily think he needed to include the whole usual laundry list that a State of the Union entails. But this was a time, I think this was a speech that it was a combination of the speech to the nation about what's going on in Ukraine, and then tacked onto it was the State of the Union message that you should give about what programs you want to enact and all that. But I thought it was an important moment. And I thought he gave a good speech in that regard. I thought his remarks on Ukraine and his were nice and bipartisan and rousing, and something that the public needed to hear.
First third of the speech was about Ukraine, which was weirdly a unifying thing. I mean, hey, what do you know? We all agreed on something.
It was funny because my 12-year-old asked me why Biden was giving a big speech, and she thought it was because of what's been happening in Ukraine. And I thought, I was like, no, you know, once a year the president has to tell the Congress how the country is doing. And she was like, huh? Yeah, it's kind of an old-timey thing because it's in the Constitution where the president once a year has to basically update Congress on what he's been doing. And it is from a bygone era. Events like this, I can neither confirm nor deny that I routinely refer to press conferences as dog and pony shows. And the State of the Union is the doggiest pony show of the There's no real news, right? Because everybody knows beforehand what the president is going to say. Shocker, the State of the Union is strong. I just wonder whether the pageantry of it all has overwhelmed any actual, you know, value it has to the country. It's become sort of another battlefield. We saw Representatives Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene attempt to seize the limelight by literally heckling the president while he was talking about his dead son.
A cancer that would put them in a flag-draped coffin. I know.
I loved State of the Unions growing up, and I was lucky enough to cover Bill Clinton's final State of the Union, and it was really one of just the most fun assignments I've ever had.
That's a sentence you don't hear that often. I love State of the Union. They didn't have ice cream trucks in your neighborhood or kickball.
They did not. No dolls either. It was full politics all the time.
See, when I was a kid, I just used to read the federal budget. I wouldn't watch the speeches.
Yes, and Austin was combing over the police records of major market cities, comparing the operations of the departments one to the other.
Parents would come in, I'd have a flashlight under the covers reading budget documents.
Well, see, I wasn't going to say that I used to watch it and then pretend to write a story about it.
Oh, well, at least that's...
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's an even deeper dive into nerddom.
See, I was going to keep that on the down low, but I feel like I've already outed myself a giant, giant nerd. So I might as well just let the freak flag fly.
Yeah, having heard the first part, we're not shocked to hear the second part. You know, I've kind of capitulated. I just sort of appreciate the pageantry of it all because I think it is sort of a mirror of America for its warts and all. You do see Joe Manchin trying to figure out what side of the fence he's on. Should I sit? Should I stand? I don't mind the fashion statements. I don't mind the people in the gallery because those are statements unto themselves. So it doesn't bother me. I guess because my expectations are low and I don't put any real import into it other than here's what America looks and feels like right now. You noticed how few people were in there. It was because I guess not only did some members of Congress not go, but also they couldn't invite friends this year, so there weren't as many people. You can put 1,500 people in there, and there were maybe 500 or 600 is all. And the last thing I'll just say about it, guys, is that I'm generally a sucker for a well-turned phrase, and I don't think that Joe Biden is a great speaker, but I buy into the optimism. I like hearing what our aspirations are. Even if it's unrealistic or sugar-coated. I mean, where else are you going to get that?
I don't mind a rousing speech once in a while. That's great. And I think, like to Eric's point, the situation in Ukraine absolutely warrants some kind of national address. And now, is there really like civic enriching content when the president says, go get him, or like, we're going to get him in Ukraine? I don't know.
God bless you all. Protect our troops. Thank you. Go get him.
That was his last moment.
But it was, and I actually appreciate it. I think like from a speechwriting perspective, you would almost want to put you'd want to backload a lot of the Ukraine stuff and sort of build, and then deliver all of those lines. But I sort of appreciate it just from a civic standpoint of beginning with what's everyone's on everyone's mind. Here's what's going on in Ukraine and what our position is. That's valuable. It's that can be a thing of civic value.
You didn't think there was some bona fide value in him saying that we do need to fund the police? I mean, to me, that's an olive branch of sorts. You did see the president reach across the aisle there.
It's an outcome of, and that was sort of an interesting thing to note about the speech, was it's sort of the new Democratic platform, which is very, very populist. You did not hear Joe Biden talking about the criminal justice reforms that he was proposing in his campaign, for example. It's a complete 180 turn from that. Securing the southern border, phrases that you would have heard from.
He didn't mention Build Back Better either.
Yeah, or, you know, in a very roundabout way sort of did. But I think that's more of a consequence of poll-tested messaging than any kind of change of heart.
He didn't mention Build Back Better, but he did list several of the key popular elements in Build Back Better that he wanted to accomplish. So he brought it up without bringing it up. John, I was struck also by his statements about defunding the police, or not defunding the police, funding the police is how he put it.
Yeah.
And how this has been a theme. I know that in the governor's race, you've seen Jesse Sullivan and Richard Ervin talking about, you know, defund. These are people who want to defund the police, implying that this is the Democratic position, that this is J.B. Pritzker's position. And I think that the more Democrats can come out and say, no, we're not for defunding the police. We are for strengthening the police, making it a smarter organization. It's a key toward undermining that message. And that's kind of, seems to me, what Ervin and Sullivan are selling right now, which is that the Democrats want to defund the police. I was really struck by what Biden said, and I think that it was important.
You know, last week, Lisa Donovan here said that it bothered her how hopeless the plight of Ukraine seemed to be, and that while we being the free nations of the nations of the free world, sympathize with the people of Ukraine, no one was going to come to their aid. We are all just sitting here now every day watching Russia bomb an outmatched neighbor. And the president renewed his pledge last night not to send our soldiers to fight there. And both sides of the aisle applauded that. It just seems like there is no hope for Ukraine. I know that they've been fighting back and the civilians are armed and Zelensky's an international hero now, but in fact, Russia will have whatever part of Ukraine it wants. It is kind of pathetic that the world is like, all right, I'll put up with higher gas prices, maybe, but that's the extent to which I'll go.
We don't. And as I pointed out last week, this is where people come for their foreign policy analysis. And so we must deliver it. The overreach that Putin has gotten involved in here seems to me to be something that he's going to come to regret, that, yes, Russian forces are going to be able to take Ukraine, just like U.S. forces were able to take Iraq. There's much stronger military. They can go in. They will have their way eventually. It's going slower than they thought, having supply chain problems and all kinds of other issues. Plus, the civilians are really fighting back, but they are outmatched. And ultimately, you're right. They're going to take Kyiv. They're going to take the major cities. But then they'll have to hold those cities because the citizenry there seems like they are very inspired to fight back, to take their country back. And that's going to be an incredible drain on Russian resources, not to mention these sanctions that we've put in place, that the world has put in place, and that has caused the ruble to plunge. And I think that this is going to be seen in history, it's my guess, as a big mistake by Putin, that it was an unforced error, an own goal. On him that he has provoked this confrontation that, yeah, he may win short term, but I can't imagine how he's going to win long term.
I have the same question. Thomas Friedman wrote about that in the New York Times today, that there are no good outcomes for this. I mean, if they put in a puppet government, he said the people will shoot at it all the time. They're going to have, you know, years of urban warfare.
I was struck just on the domestic policy side. One thing that I would have loved to have seen from the administration is some kind of acknowledgement of the massive ongoing and further coming refugee crisis out of Ukraine, and the United States being a leader in accepting many of those refugees. But that has, speaking of State of the Union, been a very, very dark spot, in my opinion, on the Biden administration, is coming in with extreme national fervor against the immigration policies of the Trump administration. And while Biden may have removed the most absurdly terrible things about those policies, it's been really, really difficult for anyone to come and build a better life in the United States under the Biden administration legally. And I think that's something that deserves a conversation, especially when there are, you know, potentially millions of people being displaced.
We should make it easier for people to come into this country.
Yeah, especially when they're being attacked by, you know, a fascist authoritarian power. Those people tend to really appreciate American values of individualism and civil liberties when they come here, too. So I think it would be a win-win.
As an employment measure, we need higher immigration rates in this country, too.
There's plenty of it. I highly recommend the book 1 Billion Americans by Matt Iglesias that makes all the great cases for why we should have a billion Americans.
And, you know, you wonder, too, if something like that were to happen in the United States, would we all pick up our arms? Would we defend our country and ourselves? And I think we would. I think that what you see is not probably any different than it is in any other country. Although Iraq, they sort of threw up their hands. But maybe that's because they didn't so love their government or country that they were willing to fight and die for it. But I think Americans under those circumstances would do the same things the people in Ukraine are doing.
Yeah, well, this is one of the arguments, of course, that the gun rights people advance, which is that having a heavily armed citizenry is a bulwark against any kind of incursion or tyranny. And I think a lot of their arguments have to do with a tyrannical U.S. government, not like the Canadians invading us or something. But I think a lot of people who are Second Amendment fans are seeing what's going on in Ukraine going like, yeah, well, this is why we need to all have guns.
This is why we all need tanks. Did you see the video of the woman who found an abandoned Russian tank? She's a pretty blonde-haired gal, had her lipstick on and civilian clothes, and she got in there and then figured out how to drive it, and off she went with her tank.
Afghanistan and Iraq are both examples of the fact that military power, pure military power, is not sufficient to transform a country. And Ukraine is huge, right? I mean, it's like, you superimpose it over the United States, and it goes from Chicago to Maine, I think. I mean, it's an enormous country. And it's not, I mean, they did roll in and they took Crimea. That's a very small area compared to the entire country of Ukraine. So, yeah, they can do it in smaller places, but I think they've bitten off way more than they can chew here. And I certainly hope that's the case. But unfortunately, a lot of blood is going to be spilled before that outcome occurs.
Okay, it's on to campaign 2022/2023 this time. Eric, why are we amending the campaign analysis part of the podcast today?
Well, we are amending this because this week got good for Mayor Lightfoot on Tuesday, middle of the day, when Arne Duncan, who is the former U.S. Education Secretary, the former CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, a great friend of Barack Obama's. He runs a nonviolent. Let me try that again. He runs an anti-violence not-for-profit. He was seen as her most likely competitor. Mary Lightfoot's most likely competitor for the election, which is a year from from the 28th of February. So we have an election coming up in about a year, and Arne Duncan was thought to be her most powerful opponent, and he tweeted out that he's not going to run. He said, you know, I'm exactly where I need to be, doing the work I love. He says the best way I can serve our city is to stay laser focused on reducing gun violence and stay engaged on our sites. And after giving it a lot of thought, he decided he wasn't going to run for mayor. And this was a good thing for Lightfoot, particularly this week, because over the weekend, Alderman Garza had given Susan Sadlowski Garza, 10th Ward, had given an interview to Ben Jarofsky, the podcaster and reader columnist, saying that she would absolutely not support Lightfoot if she runs for re-election next year. And she really ripped her a new one, saying, I've never met anybody who has managed to piss off every single person they come in contact with, police, fire, teachers, aldermen, business, manufacturing. And that's it. I've said it. I don't care. She said she absolutely would not support Lightfoot. And then following that, an email leaked out that she had sent to her staff about Greg Pratt, the Tribune's City Hall reporter, saying that she was reminding her group of top advisors, nothing given to a friendly background to Greg Pratt. And if he makes an inquiry, answer it as briefly as possible. But under no circumstances is anyone to give him anything proactively.
That's so Lori Lightfoot talking there?
Lightfoot was talking to her top staff there at that point in an email that Pratt got a hold of, and he posted on Twitter. So the week wasn't going well for Lightfoot until Duncan's announcement. And Duncan's announcement, it feels to me like it really clears the way for a whole bunch of people who were maybe thinking about running, that thought that, well, Duncan was going to come in and commandeer all the money and all the attention, and that it wasn't going to be worth it to run. So there are a bunch of names being floated out there, but it really opens up this race in a way that I didn't see coming myself.
And it's foregone conclusion that Lori Lightfoot's going to run for re-election?
So she hasn't officially announced, but she is raising money like she's running for re-election. She's hiring staff like she's running for re-election. And in these cases, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck.
Boy, she doesn't act like she wants the job anymore, though, does she, Heather? Or enjoys the job. She sure doesn't act like she's enjoying it.
She's definitely not a happy warrior. And that does present a contrast with Rahm Emanuel. You could tell every day he enjoyed it. You know, he enjoyed the back and the forth. And she enjoys having to deal with the news media significantly less than she did at the beginning of her term. That sort of makes the public perception of her always sort of aggravated, because she is usually aggravated.
Yeah, because she
is talking to the news media. However, as I've said in numerous times, you can't beat somebody with nobody. She is going to have all of the perks and the power of incumbency once the campaign gets really underway.
Austin, do you have a read on where this animus with the media came from? I mean, not that I remember when she was campaigning her smiling much, but I don't know what was the tipping point. Like, if you go back to the day that she said she would only take questions that one day from black journalists, and that was just for a day. But I just wonder where, when, and why she decided that the Tribune and the mainstream media in this town are all bad.
Well, yes, I think she has a particular animus reserved for Greg Pratt at the Chicago Tribune, which has been revealed in numerous foible emails that she sent, blatantly stating her distaste for specific reporters. I don't know, Heather could probably speak better to like what the turning point was, but from an outside observer, it seems to me that it's a lot different running against a machine and actually governing. And once you start governing, the Chicago press corps is not has sharp elbows for good reason, because the politicians in Chicago are notoriously terrible about telling the truth and giving people straight facts on things, more so than most other markets. And so that's a posture that is appropriate to have most of the time. And I think it seems to me, not to play armchair psychologist, but that the mayor assumes a very reactive and defensive posture almost by her very nature when challenged or criticized, not just by the media, but by anyone and for anything.
But I don't recall
a
time
that served her well.
I don't think it has either. But I don't recall a storyline where she got unfair or unfair treatment. I don't remember the media getting something really wrong about her or portraying her in an unfair way.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I mean, maybe there's some case to be made maybe for, you know, what is the real value of some of these more embarrassing, almost like office politics emails that have been produced
agreed,
and reporting
agreed,
on those.
Agreed on that. But even that's post,
not new.
Yeah, that's after the fact.
That's people, and you should expect any administration to expect those stories to be written and communicate accordingly. So I don't know if she has much of a leg to stand on there.
One last thing. A man named Michael Cole, while a Northwestern University student 38 years ago, had two tickets to a Chicago Bulls game, and none of his friends wanted to go with him, so he went to the game alone and then just kept the unused other ticket. He keeps all kinds of sports memorabilia. And then he recently saw a story about a game used ticket for Michael Jordan's first game at the United Center. And at auction, that ticket went for about $250,000. And he thought, wait a minute, I'm pretty sure I've got one of those. From October 26, 1984, he found the ticket. It sold at auction this week for $468,000 and no longer wants to take my phone calls. Before the auction, he was on our show and he said, you know, I'm just an ordinary guy and I'll go back to leading an anonymous life after this. But Eric, do you have any old memorabilia in the attic or the basement there?
I really don't. And it's the kind of thing that I would have thrown out in some Marie Kondo style cleaning operation if I had kept that, such a thing for more than a day. I'm just not a collector of stuff like that. But I do understand why people have things. Like, they have a souvenir of an event they went to, a stub from a concert or a game. Or a menu from a restaurant, something that is of significance to them. I really don't understand why someone who was not at the game would pay, what was it, $468,000? Would pay that much money to have this stub. And in the stories, they talk about, you know, the person, the memorabilia organization, whatever the store was saying, this ticket witnessed the first game Michael Jordan played in the NBA. I was like, the ticket didn't witness anything. The ticket was almost certainly in the guy's pocket. If tickets could witness things anyway, I don't get it. I don't get why people have such a fascination for something that doesn't connect to them. It's like autograph collectors.
Yeah.
Okay, you collect autographs to show that you saw Austin Berg on the street. You got his autograph. You saw Heather Sharon. You got her autograph. But why do people trade those things? Why does it make any difference to you to have a baseball that was hit in the stands and somebody else caught it and sold it to you? I don't understand that. So. This whole story leaves me puzzled.
Well, you know, what's puzzling to me is $500,000. Who has $500,000 to spend on that? How many millions of dollars do you have that you have $500,000 to buy a ticket to a game, like you said, you didn't even go to? There's no personal memory attached to that. So then I think, okay, that's got to be a pretty limited pool of people. I tend to equate wealth with success, and I tend to equate success with intelligence. Boy, would my wife be pissed if I said, honey, what's this $468,000? She's doing the online banking thing here. Oh, yeah, I bought a Michael Jordan ticket to a game we didn't go to that I can't do anything with either.
Well, it might be an investment, right? The thought might be, well, this thing's going to be some other sucker in a few years is going to pay $800,000 for it.
Maybe, but I mean, that's the point. You are now the richest house on the block. I mean, it was a public auction. You were the top bidder. How are you going to find somebody else to say, I want to give you $469,000 for it? That guy could have already had it, you know? I wonder how many more really rich, I don't know, Michael Jordan fans are out there who didn't already buy it when they could have. I understand the investment value, but I wonder where the next investor is.
Does anybody around the table here have, is a collector of memorabilia who can attack my views?
I will say, so we had a really fortunate thing happen in our family where in my grandparents' attic, there were beautifully preserved old 1950s and 60s Topps baseball cards that we found in a box.
Wow.
And those are I didn't consider myself a collector of hardly anything. I collect records, but those have some utility because I listen to those. These baseball cards I found as sort of beautiful art objects, and I appreciate them as such. So I think they're cool from that perspective. There's also just like over the last 3 years with all the, you know, easy money flowing, people are just looking for returns on anything. And the asset bubbles that you see in sports collectibles and cryptocurrency and whatever, I think it's totally a consequence of that. And so, yeah, I think there's like some definite bubbles happening.
What did you do with those cards?
We kept them and we're adding to the collection. So we've been trading them for other cards that we're missing. And
do you have any marquee cards? Anything of great value in there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a bunch of Ted Williams, Hank Aaron, Roberto Clemente.
Sell them, man.
It's for posterity. The Bergs of the year 3000 need to be able to have some kind of a nest egg.
But the Bergs of 2025, you and your bride are going to want to buy a house and
really
maybe a car.
Think about that, Austin.
Vacation home.
If it was enough, if you could get from those cards enough for a down payment on your first house.
Yeah, they're not mine to sell. And two, they're not like these aren't like life-changing amounts of money tied to these cards. They're just really cool to have. They are valuable, but I think we're keeping them for now. We're holding.
Okay. I would sell them for a steak dinner, but I just don't attach I don't attach myself to those sorts of things. I did ask that Michael Cole, the guy who sold this ticket, if he would produce an NFT of it. And he said, you know what? My brother-in-law, I think it was, asked me about that and asked me if I was going to do it. And he didn't seem to be up to speed on these non-fungible tokens. And I said, maybe I should look into that. I said, well, you have 3 days to look into that, because I think maybe the right to generate an NFT would pass once you no longer own the ticket. Those things are so weird. I don't even know. What's an NFT? That's where somebody gives you money for something and you give them nothing anyway. So I don't exactly understand how that works, but he was interested in it. I don't know what he did. As you know, he's not taking my call, but that doesn't hurt my feelings. I'm not.
Yeah, you're not bitter, John. We can tell.
I know. That happens all the time. They go, yeah, I'll come back on your show. Sure, we'll be happy to join you. I can't even get the governor to come on my show these days. I thought, hey, I said, J.B. Pritzker, my producer said, hey, J.B. Pritzker, why don't you come on our show this week? Because the masks have come off and you've proclaimed yourself as this Ukrainian American who gave a really rousing speech in the village. So this would be a great opportunity for him to come on. And he's been dodging us forever. And he didn't take that opportunity either. I don't exactly understand what his media strategy is these days either. I guess he controls it enough that he doesn't need to take our overtures. But, that was a safe room. Just let's rally support for Ukraine and celebrate the mask coming off. Didn't want to do it. Don't understand that. Well, that wraps it up for today.
Well, we're here for you, John.
Yeah, I know. But enough about me. I'll let you guys dive into this Madigan story, and maybe we'll talk more about it next week. Heather Sharon, Austin Berg, Eric Zorn, down south, coming back up north soon. Thanks for joining us. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Hey, John, do you think we can flip the conversation, so put the Madigan stuff at the top?
Yeah, I'll try and...
Okay, cool. I guess I thought this was a good conversation we had about that, and it's going to be topic 1, 2, and 3 in everybody's shows and... newsletters.
I'll probably be calling all of you tomorrow, asking you to come on my radio show. So thanks for the heads up.
I'm not taking your calls anymore.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.